again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Rita Sand.
Going from very little awareness of the coal plant's effects to pretty sharp awareness in a relatively short period of time was achieved because of just the completely grassroots hard work of Alvejo and Perro in their different neighborhoods.
Coming up, we'll hear from journalist Carrie Leiterson for a closer look at the activism that closed down two Chicago coal-fired power plants.
Whatever voice wants to be heard should have that opportunity. We will do much better as a democracy to get away from the two-party system.
And with the 2014 elections coming up this year, we'll hear from Scott Summers, the 2014 Green Party candidate for governor of Illinois. In 2012, activists in the Chicago neighborhoods of Pilsen and Little Village successfully closed down two old coal-powered energy plants. The energy plants were implicated in negative impacts on the environment and on the health of nearby residents. This victorious campaign was more than a decade in the making, and a fuller story of the campaign and the Chicagoans who were involved is now the topic of an e-book entitled Closing Cloud Factories, Lessons from the Fight to Shut Down Chicago's Coal Plants. The author of the e-book is Carrie Leiterson, longtime Chicago journalist and author. Carrie Leiterson spoke with Chicago Indy Media's Mitchell Stepinczyk in an interview about the e-book and issues related to the campaign in an interview recorded on Tuesday, June 17, 2014.
We're joined on the phone by Carrie Leiterson. Carrie is a Chicago-based author, educator, and journalist who specializes in energy, the environment, labor, public health, and immigration issues. She has contributed to a number of publications, as well as written a number of books. Her most recent book is an e-book entitled Closing the Cloud Factories, Lessons from the Fight to Shut Down Chicago's Coal Plants, published by Midwest Energy News. And Carrie is joining us on the phone now. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us, and welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you.
First, tell us a little bit about the book. Elaborate on what the fight is to shut down Chicago's coal plants, and why did you write the book?
Yeah, well, so Chicago had two of the only coal plants within city limits and really dense neighborhoods in the country. And they were, one of them was basically the oldest and the other one of the oldest in the country. So I've been covering the issues around these coal plants for more than a decade. And then Midwest Energy News, which is an online publication that I work for, actually had the idea of doing this ebook chronicling the campaign to close the coal plants. They ended up closing in August of 2012 after really a more than a decade of community struggle and becoming a national symbol of the shift to a different energy landscape and the national and actually even international movement to get off of coal, especially dirty old coal plants as an energy source.
And it seems like that there are two coal plants at issue. And having lived in Chicago for almost 18 years now, I'm certainly familiar with them, Crawford and Fisk. Is that right? And can you describe those a little bit more for folks in the audience who may be unfamiliar with them?
Yeah, so Fisk is the one in the Pilsen neighborhood, right on Cermak near Morgan, and then Crawford is the one in Little Village, just about 5 miles southwest of Fisk, and they're both right on the Sanitary and Ship Canal, which is the extension of the Chicago River, and they actually had their coal delivered via that canal. So Fisk was built in 1903, and it was really the first commercial scale coal plant in the country. So it was really historic and it was really crucial to Chicago's development as a city. And then Crawford was about three decades later, so, you know, also very old. And they're, because they're so old, they're relatively small, but for their size, really, they were really highly polluting, partly because they were basically grandfathered in under the Clean Air Act that required a lot tighter pollution controls for newer plants. And then the sort of lesser known coal plant, which I also deal with a little bit in the book, is the State Line plant, which is actually just across the border in Indiana. You see it kind of looming above Calumet Park on the south side, right on Lake Michigan. So that plant was owned by a different company, Midwest Generation, which was a subsidiary of Edison International, owned the Crawford and Fisk plants, and then another company, Dominion, at the time it closed, or previously another company, had owned the State Line plant, which also closed right around this same time, and that had also really contributed pollution to Chicago.
Why were the Crawford and Fisk power plants grandfathered in after the Clean Air Act was passed?
Yeah, that was just really the way the Clean Air Act was written. This was in 1970, and the thinking was that these older coal plants were going to close soon, so it was sort of like, why bother force them to install pollution controls, because the expectation was just really that they would soon be closed. But for various reasons, that just didn't end up happening, and a lot of these plants all over the country, old pre-Clean Air Act plants, continued running for 3 and 4 decades beyond when it was expected they would be closed. And the Clean Air Act does have provisions that if you make significant upgrades or repairs or expansions to a plant, you have to meet the modern standards. So that was meant to prevent these plants to, you know, continuing to run with as dirty plants. But the Midwest Generation and a lot of other companies tried to basically get around that provision by sort of claiming, and they were actually sued by the government for doing this, and violations were issued against them for sort of, you know, making repairs and upgrades, but kind of claiming that they didn't, to avoid making the, you know, the installing the modern pollution controls.
And that explains why these, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no. Well, one thing that's worth mentioning that is also a big part of the book is that even though there was this, you know, sort of allowance in the Clean Air Act for these older plants to keep running, Blagojevich, former Governor Blagojevich, of all people, actually, you know, working closely with, and because of pressure from the big environmental groups in Chicago, he actually negotiated a settlement or a rule with the different coal plant companies in Illinois that did force them to install pollution controls, so that actually Illinois' law, you know, usually states are known as kind of even laxer than the federal government in regulating environmental issues. But in this case, Illinois actually had one of the stronger state programs that required, you know, more investment in pollution controls than the federal government would really have required. So that was another thing that figured into them closing, and that was something that was gained not just because of Blagojevich, but because of the hard work by the environmental groups.
And I suppose that should be our segue to our next point. It seems clear that there was a history of these plants serving in the development and the electrification of the city of Chicago, and you discussed that some in the book. But in addition, there's also the various negative impacts, most notably on the environment because of increasing global warming gases that are being emitted, but also the health consequences because of the pollutants that these plants emit. Can you elaborate on both the environmental and health impacts and consequences of these plants lasting so long?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, back when they were built, I mean, really all the way up through like the 60s with, you know, Silent Spring and the first Earth Day and the dawning awareness of environmental issues, you know, these plants operated for decades before most people really even had any concept of the environment and the need to protect it in any way near the way that we do now. So, you know, they were dirty from day one, but people were just so desperate for economic development, and there was just so much, you know, sort of just excitement and just barreling forward with the really the building of the city and, you know, the development of industry and the Industrial Revolution still really playing out, that the pollution just wasn't an issue, and the science also wasn't near as advanced. So people just had no idea how bad things like these plants were for both the physical environment and for people's health. So in terms of the environment, well, these plants emit a lot of things. Some of the worst things are sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide that basically contribute to ozone, you know, essentially smog, and also acid rain, and then particulate matter, which is basically fine dust. So those things have, and also mercury. So those things have really serious health impacts. The particulate matter gets in your lungs and actually gets into your bloodstream and damages your organs. Your brain and your lungs and your heart are all damaged by this particulate matter. And then smog, you know, is also damaging for the body. And mercury accumulates in fish. So if you're eating fish, really anywhere, mercury has impacts over a wide area. If you're eating fish, you could get children and pregnant women who are exposed to mercury through fish can have really serious brain and neurosystem impacts and damage. So really serious health effects. And then eventually, you know, much later, early 2000s, a study came out by a Harvard School of Public Health researcher that blamed these two plants specifically, or said that they could be logically linked to, I think it was 55 premature deaths each year and like 500 some emergency room visits and just scores of asthma attacks, you know, very serious and big health impacts. And the particulate matter especially impacts the local residents disproportionately. You know, people in the surrounding blocks, or the, like in Pilsen and Little Village, are the ones really suffering these health impacts. And then there's also climate change, which, you know, it wasn't even really until the 90s that people really became widely aware of that. So that's not a localized impact, but the plants emit a lot of carbon dioxide, which is the main driver for climate change. And they were Chicago's biggest carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas source. So they were, you know, really guilty of that also. And climate change, of course, has all kinds of devastating health and environmental impacts globally. And then even locally, also the coal plant being on the river, you know, there's a lot of coal being stored and delivered there. So just the dust from the coal was polluting the river and the soil, and there's also high levels of lead in the soil that comes. The coal plant's not the main issue there, but the coal plant does contribute lead to the atmosphere and the soil. So just, you know, a whole lot of different impacts.
No doubt true. And it was no doubt as a result of all of these things that you saw the beginnings of grassroots political activism that sprung up to oppose the continued operation of these plants. And the book goes into impressive detail on this score. You chart and discuss a number of community organizers and activists who were working to close down these plants. And I'd like you to discuss some of these in the book. One of them in particular is an organization. I've known about it, a number of other Chicagoans have as well. It's known by the acronym ELVEJO, the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization. Talk about ELVEJO, if you would, please.
Yeah, so that's in Little Village. And so ELVEJO had kind of gotten started a long time ago dealing with local issues. It kind of started with this issue at the school where kids were being poisoned by fumes from new tarring of the roof. And then that one, you know, very local issue just kind of energized residents and got them active on a lot of issues. And they define environment pretty broadly to include violence and lack of parks and lack of healthy food and, you know, things in the environment, not just pollution per se, but all different things in the environment that impact quality of life and health and, you know, residents' ability to just pursue their dreams. So ELVEJO was one of the, pretty early on, Kim Wasserman was the daughter of some of the founders of ELVEJO, and she was among the first ELVEJO organizers who really, you know, started looking into what the coal plant actually was and what it was doing to people. And it was the same in Pilsen, too. You know, for decades, residents were so used to just seeing a lot of heavy industry and trucks barreling by and just a lot of pollution and debris and, you know, lack of caretaking by the authorities of their neighborhood. So the coal plant was just one more thing, and they really didn't realize how bad it was, not to mention that they had, you know, joblessness and being immigrants without documents in a lot of cases and violence and all these other challenges that in some ways seemed more pressing that they had to deal with. So it was pretty groundbreaking that ELVEJO and then separately sort of, but on a parallel track, Pero and Pilsen, recognized, you know, and started researching on their own what the effects of these coal plants were, and then really started pounding the pavement to talk to residents about it. And like Kim described to me early on, going door to door and, you know, really just trying to hear, not, this was even before she knew so much about the coal plant, just asking residents, you know, what their concerns were and what they were dealing with on a daily basis. And she was noticing how many people had what they were calling breathing problems, which was basically asthma and related things. And she started really putting two and two together and, you know, realizing that this shouldn't be normal, that so many people had breathing problems. And, you know, it made perfect sense that I was scientifically, you know, proven that particulate matter from these coal plants would really exacerbate or cause asthma. So that was, you know, going from very little awareness of the coal plants' effects to pretty sharp awareness in a relatively short period of time was achieved because of just the completely grassroots hard work of ELVEJO and Pero in their different neighborhoods.
You mentioned Pero, that is a sister group of ELVEJO. Explain that a little bit, please. What does it stand for?
Yeah, that's the right. That's the Pilsen Environmental Rights and Reform Organization, and Pero in Spanish is dog. So, you know, sort of like an aggressive or feisty dog. You can think of it that way. So they formed totally separately, and ELVEJO formed a good bit earlier. But Pero was, you know, similarly formed by a couple residents who were just noticing what seemed to be environmental threats in their neighborhood and started researching on their own and, you know, canvassing door to door to talk to residents and holding meetings and becoming really active. And Pero is maybe a little bit more focused on, you know, what would traditionally be defined as environmental issues, although they've branched out too. And, you know, and then ELVEJO, as I was describing, has worked on this wide range of issues. But what they were really, I think, one of the first ones in the country, one of the first groups in the country to really take on the issue of environmental justice, which is a pretty widely understood concept these days. But it was really just, I think, the late 80s or 90s when, you know, people especially people more in positions of power, were becoming aware of what environmental justice is and that it's something that we need to pay attention to.
I'd like you to elaborate a little bit more about the nitty-gritty on how these campaigns were able to win their goal, and pretty dramatically, of closing down these plants. It actually is the subtitle of the book, The Lessons to Fight to Shut Down Chicago's Coal Plants. Both the plants were shut down, and it seems like it was directly due to the activism. Is that fair to say? And if so, what exactly were the things that these activists did to shut down the plants?
Well, what makes it an interesting story is just how complicated and long the whole struggle was. You know, it was right after the turn of the millennium that the focus was really turned to the coal plants in both neighborhoods, and it was 2012 when they closed down. So we're talking over the course of 12 years. So they pursued all different strategies, starting from the very basics of educating people and rallying people, and then they worked on the and then, you know, at some point the bigger environmental groups, the groups like the Environmental Law and Policy Center and the Natural Resources Defense Council and the Sierra Club and Greenpeace and others I'm leaving out too, became more and more active on these coal plants and put them in the context of their larger missions. And then the really interesting and exciting thing was that all these groups started working together, and, you know, it's not easy for different groups with different backgrounds and different geographic locations and different funding sources or no funding sources, you know, to have even like a few groups work together is a pretty big challenge. And the coalition that eventually coalesced to work on closing the power of the coal plants was scores of groups. It was, you know, the complete list is over 30, I think, and there was, you know, I think at least 10 or so that were very deeply on a day-to-day level involved. So anyway, in terms of how the closing came about, there were Chicago politics involved. There was the agreement that, you know, with Blagojevich that I mentioned. This, the coal plants eventually became a, the neighborhood groups have been pressing for a decade to get the aldermen in both neighborhoods and Mayor Daley to take on the coal plants. And there was just extreme recalcitrance or resistance to that. It's never clear exactly why. Midwest Generation definitely threw around some money and made campaign donations. And there were probably bigger issues too, and also just sort of political inertia. So the groups eventually succeeded in turning the political tide once Mayor Daley was out of office and Rahm Emanuel was mayor, and then Danny Solis, the alderman in Pilsen, was facing losing his seat in 2011 because of the coal plants issues. So he switched course and became an advocate of cleaning up the coal plants or shutting them down at the last minute. So that was one of the reasons. So I guess to sum it all up, and the other thing that was a really crucial factor was economics, the rise of fracking and the fact that natural gas became so cheap, and these coal plants were selling power on an open market where they were competing with power generated by wind and by natural gas fired plants. And then also during the economic crisis, demand for electricity went down, so the plants did just become a lot less financially viable. So all these things kind of combined, all these forces, the economics, the neighborhood groups, or any, you know, the groups, the struggle probably didn't have much or anything to do with the economic forces, but they had everything to do with the Blagojevich agreement and with the city politics shift and, you know, with other things that led indirectly and directly to the plants closing.
Is there anything in this story that you feel like should be mentioned that I haven't touched on?
Well, I guess the thing that's natural to bring up is, so they closed 2 years ago, like, why is the story still relevant? And I think it definitely is. For one thing, the plants physically are still sitting there, and it still remains to be seen what's done with the sites, which are in neighborhoods which are starved of green space, don't have enough green space, don't have enough jobs. So there's a really meaningful debate going on, and also a formal process involving Pero and Alvejo to help determine what will be done with those sites. So that's pretty interesting. And then, you know, more importantly, all those relationships that were formed during this campaign still exist. You know, they're a little bit more dormant, like people don't get together as much now as they did when they were meeting constantly. But I think those relationships and the lessons people learned about working together will probably live on and bear fruit in different ways for many years. And people who were involved are saying that, you know, even now they're getting tons of interest from other groups of all types around the country who want to learn from their campaign here in Chicago. So it's definitely, you know, become a piece of history, something for the history books in terms of environmental justice and community organizing.
And for folks who would be interested in getting a copy of Closing the Cloud Factory's Lessons from the Fight to Shut Down Chicago's Coal Plants, how can they find or buy a copy?
Yeah, well, the ebook is actually free, and then the Kindle version is just a couple dollars. So you can easily get either of those by going to Midwest Energy News website, which is midwestenergynews.com. /ebook, but you should be able to find it on the main site too. And we've also been circulating some paper copies, which if someone really wants a paper copy, they could get in touch with Midwest Energy News and get their hands on one. And we'll also be working on a Spanish translation that hopefully will be out before too long.
We've been speaking with Kari Leiterson. She is a Chicago-based author, educator, and journalist who specializes in energy, environment, labor, public health, and immigration issues, who has published in a number of publications across the United States and has written a number of books. Her most recent book, an e-book, Closing the Cloud Factory's Lessons from the Fight to Shut Down Chicago's Coal Plants, published by Midwest Energy News. Kari, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
That was an interview with Kari Leiterson, recorded on June 17, 2014, connected to the ebook Closing the Cloud Factories, Lessons from the Fight to Shut Down Chicago's Coal Plants. Kari Leiterson's website is KariLeiterson.com, spelled KariLeiderson.com. We're coming to you from the trenches.
It's not easy being green, having to spend each day the color of the leaves. When I think it might be nicer being red or yellow or gold or something much more colorful like that. It's not easy being green. Seems you blend in with so many other ordinary things, and people tend to pass you over because you're not standing out like flashy sparkles in the water or stars in the sky. But green's the color of spring, and green can be cool and friendly like. And green can be big like a mountain, or important like a river, or tall like a tree. When green is all there is to be, it could make you wonder why. But why wonder? Why wonder? I'm green, and it'll do fine. It's beautiful, and I think it's what I want to be.
...2014 marks an election year, and candidates of third parties in Illinois and across America continue to struggle to provide an alternative to the Democratic-Republican political duopoly in American electoral politics. Those efforts can sometimes face setbacks, as in the case with Scott K. Summers, the 2014 Green Party candidate for governor of Illinois. Scott Summers and Green Party efforts in Illinois have been struggling to regain a spot on the ballot for the 2014 Illinois gubernatorial race. Scott Summers discussed those efforts, along with other topics, in an interview with Chicago Indy Media's Mitchell Stepinchik, recorded on Tuesday, June 17, 2014.
We are joined on the phone by Scott Summers. Scott Summers is an attorney, a former elected official, and author who is also running for the Illinois Green Party candidate for governor in 2014, and he is joining us on the phone. Scott, thank you so much for your time. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Mitch. Appreciate it.
Let's begin with the first question that I always ask for people who are running for public office. Why are you running for public office? Why are you running for governor?
Well, that's kind of a long story. I am a baby boomer. I'm 65 years old now. I see the way things are going. I think of my two young adult sons and all the other younger people that we are not leaving a very good state or very good world to, and I figure if I don't do something now at my age, I'm not going to do it at all. So that's part of my motivation. I am a policy person by training and experience, so I've long had an interest in this type of thing. Indeed, I was once an elected official. I was a trustee at McHenry County College. It's a community college up on the state line. And so I do have that bit of background. I am an attorney. I am an MPA. I think I could bring a lot to the dialogue about the finances of the state, which is, I think we all know are in pretty desperate shape, desperate being a polite word.
Explain some more about the campaign, if you would, please. What is it about your campaign that is different, if you're trying to sell it, to people who might be unhappy with other political campaigns? What do you provide that's different, or can be different?
Well, common sense, if anything, and that's kind of the most important aspect of this. I mean, all sorts of charades go on in Springfield, and I'm going to tell it like it is as the Green candidate for governor. We have to do a lot to get our financial ship back and right our financial ship, I guess, to say it that way. Also, programmatically, there's much to be desired with the states right now, so I hope to bring my perspective and my experience to bear.
I'd like you to talk a little bit about the effort that you've been encountering to actually get on the ballot to run for governor of Illinois. Let me quote one friend of mine who sent me an email explaining that, it, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, it requires roughly about 40,000 raw signatures, as they're called, to get on the ballot. The Green Party has to petition as a new party in 2014 and need a great many signatures in order to survive a challenge. The roughly about 25,000 quality signatures, which would mean about 40,000 raw signatures, as they're called, whereas established parties only need about 5,000 quality signatures for state public office. First off, let me ask, is this correct? And secondly, if so, what accounts for this discrepancy?
It's part of the state's election code. They have two classes of political parties, as you point out. One is established political parties, which at this time are the Democrats and the Republicans. And every time that an established party in a general election drops below 5% of the total vote, then they are no longer considered an established party and, in fact, have to start over. The Greens were established for a brief period of time in 2006. 10% of the vote went to Rich Whitney, who was my predecessor as candidate for governor. And on that basis, there were 4 years where the Greens also were an established party. However, in 2010, we did not pull more than 5% on that basis. Our abilities to be an established party with the lower signature thresholds that you described, we lost that. In fact, have to start over, as would any other political party at this time. This is all part of the election code. It's basically made up to frustrate independence, new political parties. You point out, yes, indeed, the signature requirement for established parties, Democrats and Republicans, is 5 to 10,000. For a new party or for an independent candidate, it's 25,000. As you point out, indeed, 40,000 or so to be saved in terms of surviving the challenge. It's all set up in statute this way. It's very daunting, it's punishing, it's punitive. It really chokes off our democracy the way it's set up here in Illinois. As we all know, the Democrats, the Republicans went through their primary in March. It's only now that new parties and independents perhaps are going to be petitioning, which really shrinks the time frame. And not only that, if there are indeed challenges, it may be a month or two before the Greens or anybody else who is attempting to get on the ballot will even be able to know that they're going to be on the November ballot. So it's very challenging. I mean, the compressed time frame is almost meant to frustrate new people. Indeed, the signature requirement is as well. The way we go about it in Illinois in terms of signature challenges, I think it's fraught with inconsistency. I could go on and on and on, but I mean, we really as a state are shortchanging ourselves by not having equal access to the ballot.
What would you advocate for instead? It would sound like obviously a lower threshold to get on the ballot, or maybe permanent status once you've been established as a party status. What are you calling for?
Well, I think a lower signature requirement certainly would be one possibility. There are other things that other states do in terms of ballot qualification. Some people are just put on the ballot, not people but parties, if they pay a fee, a few thousand dollars, and then there is no signature requirement. So they have to get on the ballot with a fee to basically help with their processing. I really think that that type of thing would help to open it up. Certainly the independent maps approach is another avenue. If indeed we were to get that constitutional amendment onto the ballot and passed, we will have a much easier time of redistricting. And as I think all your listeners know, it's very, very gerrymandered into safe Republican districts, safe Democratic districts. And it's that type of a situation that I think we would at least get out of that type of a scratch my back and I'll scratch yours sort of situation. There's several other things that can be done. And one thing that I always am hearing is that, well, you're the Green Party, you're going to spoil it for candidate X or candidate Y. You're going to take away votes from him or her, and on that basis, that person will not be elected, and it'll be your fault, Green Party, for, taking away votes. Now, we heard a lot about that in 2000 when Ralph Nader ran for president. It's a fallacy. It's a bogus argument as far as I'm concerned. If new parties can get on the ballot, they are following the rules that the state has put up, onerous as they are, and anybody who makes the ballot has a right to be there. I don't have to tell people that I have to get off the ballot for the sake of somebody else. I don't want to disenfranchise any of the voters who might want to vote for me. It's just a very imperious sort of an attitude people take in respect to, people so-called spoiling elections. There is a way around that. Some communities around the country have started this. It's called instant runoff voting, IRV. And I'll describe it very briefly. It negates the whole concept, bad as it is, of the spoiler effect, because you rank the candidates. So, for example, we have Mr. Rauner, Mr. Quinn running for governor. Say I were to be running for governor, say a Libertarian or somebody else is running for governor, you could go into the voting booth and say, well, I'll take Summers first and then Quinn second and Rauner third, whatever. And on that basis, then the person, let's just say it's me and Quinn and Summers, okay? I mean, and Rauner. Me and Quinn and Rauner. If somebody voted for me one, and then Quinn two, and then Rauner three, and if I got third place in that balloting, then in effect, I would be dropped from further consideration. Anybody who voted for me as a first choice would have their second choice move up, and on that basis, all the votes would be recalculated, retabulated, and on that basis, there's always a 50% plus winner. That's another problem we've had in this state. We get pluralities as little as 20% in primaries. It's just way, way off track in terms of the way we do things. But it's all done to protect the political interests and power.
Speaking more to the immediate, how is your campaign faring with regards to the amount of signatures that you need in order to either reach ballot access or to reach that safe zone, as you call it, where you think you have enough signatures to get ballots. How is your campaign doing on that score?
Well, it's me and a slate of candidates, as you may be aware. We have a very fine group of people running for Senate, Attorney General, Secretary of State, the whole bit. Indeed, I can identify them and give a brief intro to each of them, maybe in a moment or two. But I think we are quite close as a group to getting the 25,000. This is the last weekend. Petitions have to be filed Monday. How far beyond 25,000 we get, I'm certainly very hopeful. But if it's less than, say, 35,000, we're almost assured a challenge, and most likely challenged by the Democratic Party.
What are your odds, then, about winning if you are challenged? Any idea about that?
It depends on a lot of things. Basically, I think it's the way that the petitions are groomed, I guess, for lack of a better word. People, you know, sometimes their signatures are illegible, or they leave off an address, or any number of things could be technically wrong. I had a case just recently where a person just put their zip code down. They have to put down the town. That type of thing is easily remedied. I mean, I can look up the zip code and find the name of the town. So, in effect, we rehabilitate signatures before we submit them. That increases our rate of good signatures, and on that basis lowers the number of signatures that can be challenged. So we try to prepare petitions in such a way that the signatures, as many as we're able to, can survive being challenged. So we do try to rehabilitate signatures in that fashion before they are submitted.
Are there any particular points of your campaign that you're particularly interested in? What are the burning issues that you feel like aren't being addressed that you feel you want to address should you become governor?
Well, for me, it's finances. And I think people know generally about the Green Party. We're best known for our ecological stands. But we're very much a people-oriented party. We are really way off track here in the state in terms of human services, health care, and education in particular. I am, by way of training, an attorney and an MBA, and I, in my campaign, I'm going to be emphasizing finances, green being the color of money, among other things. It's a tack that not too many green candidates have taken in the past, but our state finances are so abysmal in terms of their structure and in terms of their patently unfair taxation that I think I can bring a lot to bear in terms of the dialogue. Let me give three different things that I would attempt to put forward as new ideas that would be very beneficial to the state. One would be for a fairer tax system. We have, as a state, one of the most regressive tax systems in the country. What that means is that people with the least amount of money pay a much more disproportionate tax rate between property taxes, sales taxes, telephone taxes, all the other taxes that are brought to bear. I would like to, okay, let's talk about the income tax in the state as well. Illinois has a flat rate income tax. That's done by way of the Constitution, was adopted in 1970. We as a state are one of only, and I think it's in the vicinity of 7 or 8 or 9, I'm sorry, I don't know the exact number, we are one of the very few states with an income tax that does it on a flat rate basis. On that step, I think what we'd like to do, I would like to do, is get a stair-step system very much the way the federal government does income tax. In effect, it goes up, the rate goes up based on the money you make. The more you make, the more you pay. I think that's a graduated income tax is a much fairer system than a flat rate tax. So that would be one thing to do. I would restructure the sales tax. It's really obsolete in many ways. It's one of the go-to taxes as the property tax is. It's patently unfair. You and I pay the same amount of tax on a loaf of bread or a pair of shoes that Bill Gates would, and that really should change. I mean, it's a very punishing tax in that respect. There's some other things we can do, and this is one that I think will strike a nerve. I believe that the time has come to have a financial transactions tax in Illinois. We could we have a lot of financial activity, of course, on LaSalle Street in Chicago, commodities, futures, derivatives, that type of thing. And we certainly welcome that business activity. It's a wonderful economic engine for the state. I don't mean to disparage it or anything like that, but they are not paying their fair share. We had to, as a state, give a lot of incentives, financial incentives, to the Chicago Mercantile Exchange to remain in town. I mean, this is one of the corporate games, right? People say, well, I'm going to leave unless you give us money. And that's basically a zero-sum game nationally. I mean, states are competing with other states. It's really a foolish way to be going about governing, but I digress. A financial transactions tax of $1 on a $10,000 trade would bring literally at least $1 billion a year, billion with a B, and probably more. I have not worked up the figures in detail at this point. Obviously, I'm at the beginning of the campaign. That would be a fair share of tax for an industry that is not paying any tax now. There's the threat that they would leave the state if they were taxed. I'm not so sure they would, but that's a game of bluff or a game of chicken that they have played before. I'm not afraid of that at all. But $1 on a $10,000 trade, that's 0.1% tax. On the New York Stock Exchange, there's a tiny tax. I think it's 0.0037 or something like that. That is used to fund the Securities and Exchange Commission, the federal agency, of course, that regulates that type of thing. They generate an enormous amount of money, I'm told, for the SEC to be funded based on that teeny tiny tax, and there's no reason why we can't do that in Illinois. The third financial thing I would be suggesting is the establishment of a state bank, a state of Illinois bank. And on that basis, this is something that's been tried successfully. Actually, it's been for many years in North Dakota. I think Vermont is getting into it now. It's something that's been talked about in the past. But here's what happens. Our state tax dollars, when we have them invested, invariably are going to Wall Street. If we have a state bank here in Illinois where we can invest our tax dollars, channel those tax dollars to Illinois businesses, Illinois activities, I think we as a state would be doing much better supporting our people and not exporting their tax dollars.
What you just described, and really the thrust of your campaign, it sounds like are the kinds of things that I imagine that most people would support. But yet most people would, I would understand, feel frustrated regarding the current political process in the United States and in Illinois, that it's too much enthralled to big power, to corporate money, to away from the concerns of everyday working people and most everyone. What do you do, or what do you say whenever you hear this? How do you address that concern that people would feel frustrated regarding electoral politics in the United States?
Well, I certainly empathize with it. I wish things were easier for parties like the Greens nationally. Indeed, if we as a populace, not only just in Illinois, but across the country, start trying to demand a little bit better opportunity for third parties, I think we would do a lot better. I'm very hopeful in this campaign that I can articulate some of these things and at least the ideas might be brought to bear. Certainly have other ideas that we can discuss. And again, I'm emphasizing the finances in my campaign. But there's really, it's designed to frustrate the voters. We will not have our message or our ideas moneyed. We are not for sale. And that's something that we think is very positive. I mean, we, in effect, make it difficult for ourselves in terms of money, but we are not beholden to anyone. And people can give us, you know, $5, $10, $50, $100, as much as they are able, small contributions. They will help us get the message out. And anybody who feels frustrated, it can, with confidence, send money to the Illinois Green Party. Indeed, I should give their party website. It's ilgp.org. Make a donation for the state slate. We will get the word out, and it will be the true word, I think, in terms of what common sense dictates. Not the true word, I should just say it's common sense. The things I'm advocating, I think, are common sense. And we're very hopeful that people across the state will say, you know, enough is enough. The Democrats and Republicans, they have run the state into a ditch. Let's at least hear out the Greens, maybe, you know, the Libertarians, whoever. I mean, let's hear out these parties. I want to make another point about that, too. We, as school children, are basically hardwired for a two-party system. I remember well, as a child, I think maybe fourth grade, fifth grade, my teacher extolling the virtues of American democracy and how the Democratic and Republican parties make the nation
great. Well, I think looking around at things in Washington, looking around at things in Springfield, it ain't so. Two examples of how it works in other countries. One is Canada, one is the United Kingdom. Parliamentary democracies, both, of course. Both those countries have two major parties in their parliaments, and they have two minor parties. And, you know, their parliamentary style of government has not been brought to its knees by the presence of minor parties. If anything, it has stimulated the discourse and kept the big parties on their toes. And we can do that here. We will be doing ourselves a favor to get other voices into government and electing libertarians or Greens or Constitution Party or, I'll be a little facetious, the Cupcake Party. Whatever voice wants to be heard should have that opportunity. We will do much better as a democracy to get away from a two-party system.
I'd like you, if you could follow up now regarding one thing you had just mentioned in this interview. You had briefly mentioned that there's a full slate of Greens running in 2014. Could you mention them? And could you also mention, if folks are interested in learning more and in getting involved in the campaign, what should they do?
All right, well, let's start with that question first. I gave the web address for the Illinois Green Party. It's ilgp.org. Check the website. My campaign website is my name, SUMMERS, Summers for FOR Governor, all one word, .org. That's SummersForGovernor.org. So those are opportunities. There is a national Green Party as well, but that's more of a loose confederation of state Green Parties. I'm being a little simplistic in saying it that way. I'll give the national Green Party address as well. It's gp.org, very easy, greenparty.org, gp.org for the national party. Actually, that's another point, too. The Green Party is established in countries throughout the world. It's been a force in Germany, in Australia. I think now the Canadians have somebody in their parliament who's a Green Party member. This is a worldwide political movement. It crosses boundaries, and I think that's a very important plus here for the Greens here in Illinois. Obviously, we are a nascent party. We are in our infancy. We're trying very hard, but we do have confederates, I guess I should say, throughout the world who espouse the same general ideas as we do, and I think that's a very positive thing, too, in terms of political parties. Let me run down the list of people in addition to me for governor. My lieutenant governor running mate is a gentleman named Bob Pritchett, P-R-I-T-C-H-E-T-T. He's from downstate Roseville, Illinois. He is a retired educator. He was a school superintendent, a vocational director, and high school business teacher. So a lot of things wrong with education in this state. And as far as I'm concerned, Bob would be our, I say this with affection, education minister portfolio. I mean, that's just to lighten up what I'm saying a little bit. Bob's educational expertise will be absolutely wonderful given all the morass that education has become in this state. Julie Samuels of Oak Park is our treasurer candidate. She's been an advocate for environmental and social justice issues for a number of years. She's been organizing residents in Chicago and some of the underserved neighborhoods, working on community development and open space and community gardens, environmental issues. She's a terrific person. She's a heartbeat of our party, and I'm thrilled to be running with Julie. Tim Curtin is the controller candidate. He's from Berwyn. He's a 40-year member of the union. I think it's the United Electrical Workers Union. And he's been a union organizer for most of his life, a terrific person as well. I'm very pleased to be running with Sheldon Schaefer. That's S-C-H-A-F-E-R. He's our Secretary of State candidate. He's from Peoria. He is a retired professor. He teaches now part-time at Bradley University down there in Peoria. He's a former Peace Corps volunteer a number of years ago, and he, I think, was in Haiti. I'm not sure about this. I think perhaps after the earthquake, but a very devoted man, and he has some good ideas, too, in terms of how to improve the Secretary of State's office. In fact, let me do that quickly as an aside. We have fresh ideas. Here's one example. I think Sheldon will be talking about this in terms of Secretary of State's office. This is just one example of the common sense pride ideas that we have. We all have to get stickers every year for our license plates. At this point, the police have scanning software that instantly can determine if a license plate is valid. We don't need license plate stickers in this state anymore. Everybody still has to pay an annual fee to have their car registered, but the police can know in an instant just by holding up a scanning device to a license plate. They can figure out whether or not the plates are valid. We don't need to have the sticker anymore. That would save us millions of dollars. The state of New Jersey is doing that. So this is not an idea that's untried. The state of New Jersey has already dropped their sticker program. I have literally dozens of ideas like that, bright, small, common sense ideas that we would like to bring to bear. And indeed, that would be for Sheldon to advocate as a Secretary of State candidate. David Black of Belvedere is our Attorney General candidate, a wonderful man with a big heart, very good legal mind. I'm very proud to be running with David. He has been an attorney for the United Auto Workers Union in Belvedere. They have the Chrysler plant up there, of course, and he has been working for many years there. It's a legal services program they have for the union members, and David has been providing his exemplary legal service for that union. And last but certainly not at all least is Omar Lopez. He is our U.S. Senate candidate. He is a longtime advocate and organizer for immigrant rights and justice. These are very important issues, too, and Omar will be a terrific articulator and advocate for these sorts of things. He is, I think, the director of a nonprofit group that provides help to people with HIV/AIDS. And he is a resident of the Belmont Cragen neighborhood, I believe, in Chicago. So that's the seven candidates: Summers for governor, Pritchett lieutenant governor, Samuels for treasurer, Curtin for controller, Schaefer for secretary of state, Black for Attorney General, and Lopez for U.S. Senate. We also have some congressional candidates as well. One locally in the 5th District, Nancy Wade, is running as the Green Party candidate against Mike Quigley on the Northwest side. The Republicans have not fielded a candidate. Nancy is a terrific person, and I think she will do very well. She has a lot to offer that, frankly, Mike Quigley does not. Downstate at the Little Egypt area, we have Paula Bradshaw running for Congress. This is an area that would extend from the Metro East area, East St. Louis, Bellevue, that sort of area, and then over toward Carbondale, another terrific candidate. So we are very hopeful. We have quality people, good ideas. Again, we do not take the corporate money. We rely on grassroots contribution. We are going to tell it like it is.
We have been speaking with Scott Summers. He is an attorney, a former elected official, and author who is also running for governor in Illinois as the Green Party candidate in 2014. Scott, thank you so much for your time.
Mitch, I appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity. I hope we can speak again.
That was an interview with Scott Summers, the Illinois Green Party's 2014 candidate for governor, recorded on June 17, 2014. Scott Summers' campaign website is summersforgovernor.org. That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. If you'd like to learn more or get involved, including helping to make this radio program, please visit the website of the Chicago Indy Media Center at chicago.indymedia.org. You can also listen to past episodes of From the Trenches on our podcast on iTunes or online at chicago.indymedia.org. I'm Rita Sand, and thank you for listening. Be sure to join us again for another episode, From the Trenches.